Okay, thank you very much. Yes, we've moved territories, I'm afraid. I'm the one person here with an English accent. But you'll understand me, I hope. Okay. Which one do I press? The left one. That one. Okay. This is the outline of the talk. I think I ought to introduce you very briefly to Lima Grain. I don't do corporate stuff. You're okay. But I think that it's not a country, a company that's particularly well-known over here. So I'll give a little bit of background onto there. I'm then going to outline what I see as the Green Revolution Mark One. And let's make no mistake, we need to produce Green Revolution Mark II if we want to feed the world. I'm going to talk a little bit about wheat production in the UK, current. Look at it, the historical viewpoint. Then I'm going to speculate about that Green Revolution number two. And some of that will give us an insight into opportunities with new technology. Now, some of the points I'll make have already been covered by previous speakers. That's the downside of being last in the list. But I hope that some of them might actually cause a little bit of perhaps conflict and interest as well. So, Lima Grain, it's a cooperative. I'm paid by 600 French farmers, who are really very nice people, and they produce rather nice wine. But it has a worldwide research network. You can see that all over Europe is the main key area, but also into the States. And it has ambitions to become the number one wheat breeder across the world. In terms of seed company, it's fifth largest in the world, but actually a very long way behind, and a very long way behind the very big companies like Monsanto and Syngenta. And therefore, it depends on partnerships. It's very much a company that works in partnership with other businesses. So, moving to our wheat breeding activities. We are the European leader. Doesn't mean anything really long term. What we want to be is sustain that position. But we've decided to also invest in other parts of the world. And as I say, the intention is to become wheat breeder of choice across the world. So let's look back and talk about the Green Revolution. Now, I'm going to mention something slightly contentious. That was in 1964. The government passed the Plant Variety Rights Act. And that actually incentivized plant breeders to invest in breeding. And it's very, very significant because for the first time, breeders could get a return on their level of investment. And that meant the level of investment increased. We also increased nitrogen usage, short semi-dwarf varieties. Fungicides became part of our normal rational use for growing wheat. And plant growth regulators were used on 98% of the wheat crop. We introduced tramlines. Some people may not understand the term tramlines. Basically, it just means that the farmer will always follow those same wheelings every year. And now with GPS technology, he can find exactly the same wheelings every year. Small thing, but it all added up to increase output. And I would say that the UK was probably at the forefront of the Green Revolution. And it finalized that by introducing high-tech equipment. Combines that didn't leave any grain on the ground behind them, sprayers, drills, and recently GPS technology. So the 1964 Plant Variety Rights Act, it provided breeders with royalty payments for varieties and enhanced the incentives for plant breeding. And it created a competitive market. And I work in probably the most competitive market, I suspect, in the world. And that meant that there was an increased scale of plant breeding. Now, the acreage in the UK is only 2 million hectares, 5 million acres. Very small for the US. But the scale of activity is huge. So I'm grateful to Dr. Ian Mackay of the National Institute of Agricultural Botany for this slide. And you'll see that yields have increased threefold in winter wheat since 1948. And that's as a result of both improved varieties and agronomy. A number of other speakers have mentioned the synergy between variety improvement and agronomy. You can't have one without the other. And you'll see that on the top line, wheat has produced the highest yields and has been shown to have the highest levels of improvement. And that's a reflection of the amount of investment that's gone in. To a certain extent, barley and oats are very much Cinderella crops in the UK compared to wheat. And there's the line for winter wheat, and you'll see that since 1964, that magic year, yields have been increasing very significantly. And if you look at the linear trends in yield, which are even more interesting, you'll see that if you look from 1982 to 2007, that the majority of that improvement has come through genetic gain. And therefore, over the previous years, we were looking up until the mid-1980s, at about a 50-50 split between yield potential per se and agronomy. Now we're looking at 75% of the improvement is due to genetic gain. Now you may say, well, question was raised, is it really genetic gain? And the answer is yes, because all of our trials are treated with full fungicide programs. And what's interesting is that the nitrogen use, again, you'll see in the 1970s, the arrival of semi-dwarf varieties, big increases in the use of nitrogen. But now that's plateaued. You'll see that over the last 20 years, nitrogen usage has actually stabilized, and yet yields have gone up very significantly. So these varieties are actually utilizing nitrogen much more efficiently. Now, these are my wheat yields from 1200. Brett asked us to look backwards. Well, in the UK, we have a little bit of history, so we can do that. And if you look at the two years I've outlined are really 1970 and 2008. And you'll see that yields have increased from 4 tonnes a hectare to 8.4 tonnes a hectare. Now, I suspect many of you will be confused by tonnes per hectare. So I've done it in bushels per acre for you as well. And you'll see that 1970, the average wheat yield in the UK was 144 bushels per acre, and in 2008 was 302. Now, people think that it rains all the time in the United Kingdom. It doesn't, but it does rain consistently. We actually only get about 24, 25 inches of rain a year, but we get about 2 inches every month. If we look at the amount of land, 2 million hectares, average yield, 8.4 tonnes per hectare, 302 bushels per acre. Total production, 17.5 million. And we are actually big exporters of wheat. But let's look at potential yields. 8.4 is the average, so that many growers actually achieve far greater than that. 12 tonnes per hectare, 432 bushels per acre is not unusual. So there must be a lot of growers who are only growing an average of 4 tonnes per hectare. Those are the ones where we need to really increase yield. So why do farmers not achieve the potential of the crop? Wrong variety choice. The advantage of having a Plant Variety Rights Act is that you actually get lots of seed merchants who sell varieties, and farmers are subject to using the wrong variety. And they reduce their fungicides. They think it's a cost saving. Oh, I've taken £10,000 off my fungicide bill. Yes, Mr. Farmer, but you've lost £50,000 worth of grain. But as they never saw it, they don't worry about it. Reduce nitrogen because of fear of lodging. Lodging is a key attribute of a variety. Many farmers are still not operating at the peak of the response curve. And we have rotational difficulties, second wheats. 40% of the UK crop is a second wheat, and take all is a major problem. And there are environmental issues. Yes, it does rain a bit, we get lodging and we get rainfall at harvest. Now, I talked about fungicides. As I say, we're not owned by an agrochemical company. We work very closely with them. And this graph comes from BASF. And you'll see that without a fungicide, you're looking at yields of around 9 tonnes per hectare. That's the red bar chart on the left. And these give you the differences with the changes in fungicide programs. Obviously, a big increase with the first generation, moving on the second generation of fungicides. And now we're into the third generation of fungicides, and you'll see very big increases in yield. And that happens with all varieties, that the mean response is 3 tonnes a hectare. Now, the interesting variety actually is this one down the bottom here, which, despite what you throw at it, doesn't respond at all. This is a variety we have currently coming forward, a variety called Stig. And that one actually yields exactly the same with fungicide as without fungicide. So that's going to be an interesting. So let's move forward. So that's the backward look. We've found that we've been good at producing wheat. We've benefited from the Green Revolution, the short semi-dwarf varieties. But now actually the second Green Revolution is going to be constrained by many more issues, environmental issues. But we still got to base it upon the ethos of the first Green Revolution. And that means interactive disciplines. It means new varieties. And it also means looking at some of the issues that were raised earlier on this afternoon. We've got to look at increasing photosynthetic efficiency. We've got to actually produce more biomass. We've got to look at genetic modification. And yes, we've got to look at hybrid wheat again. If we really want to take yields to another level, we've really got to address some of these issues. Now, I talked about Limagrain being a cooperative. It is. We're very cooperative. We work with everybody. This is just an example of government funding in the UK. And these are particular projects that we work in. I'm not going to go through them all because time is limited. But you'll see that we work with all sorts of research institutes, the University of Nottingham, Broomsbarn, the National Institute of Agriculture Botany, the John Innes Centre, on a whole host of different subjects, whether they be disease or end-use purposes. I talked about the first Green Revolution being an interaction of disciplines. This is how very much we see the second Green Revolution. It's not about us parking ourselves on the side and expecting the public sector to do the bits and pieces. It's working with the public sector and utilising the benefits of both the public and the private sector together. So if we're going to look at new varieties, we've got to look at novel germplasm. Alien introgressions, synthetics, novel dwarfing genes, and I'll put hybrid wheat again. I love this slide. One day I'm going to find this man's grave and plant some wheat on it. This is Sir Roland Biffin, who actually did the job I did 100 years ago. A man obviously with a sense of humour, but actually if you look at that wheat of ear, which is of course a simulation, it does perhaps point forward as to where we ought to be going. If you look at what we do in our own programme, this is a slide which just basically looks at the genetic resources that we have available to us. And I'm going to talk a little bit about phenotyping. Lots of talk about genotyping, but actually phenotyping is really important. And you see that we actually will go from the marketplace through choice of strategy, either conventional breeding or breeding via genetic modification through official registration. And we're very happy to talk about transgenics. We're actually the market leader in organic wheat in the UK, but we're quite happy to talk about transgenics as well. But we must use all of these disciplines together. Genotyping, phenotyping, whatever technology is available to us, we must utilise it. We need to produce 50% more wheat in the world in the next 20 years. And actually, by burying our head in the sands, not utilising these technologies, we'll not be able to achieve it. For those who are unfamiliar, this is the Predigree breeding program. It's very slow, very laborious, it's very efficient, and it's very large. As a rough rule of thumb, we put into the ground every year somewhere in the region of 250,000 hedgerows. We can now plant at 120 hedgerows a minute. But at the end of the day, it's a long-term process, and somehow we need to speed that process up. I talked about phenotyping. This is a very significant part of our activities. Phenotyping, basically what we do in the field. Yes, we've got all these clever drills. This is some of the most fantastic technology. It's a yellow one here. We call it a Sampo, but I think you call it something different, a Kincaid. This technology is unbelievable, unbelievable. I have 11 combines. I have 5 with automatic weighers on. It has transformed my life. It has transformed the selection efficiency that we can have. This particular sprayer here, very accurate for our equipment. What we're looking at is looking at developing trials which we can believe. If I get a CV over 2.5, I start to get worried. And look at this new technology here. Now, there's a quiz here. That doesn't look terribly new technology, does it? It's a man, on the back of a drill with a tractor. But actually, if you home in a little bit earlier, you see this man's not driving the tractor. This is all GPS technology. We're now drilling our trials. Well, I'm not drilling them. Seven satellites are drilling the trials. And this is all part of the range of technologies that we must bring to bear if we've got any chance of producing these higher yields. All this man does is turn the tractor around at the end of the field. We'll look at our laboratory investment now. Remember, this came about because we had plant variety rights. Single seed descent, we're producing around 45 to 50,000 single seed descent rows. And we have double haploids now. We have ambitious plans to produce 100,000 double haploids in the next 5 years. And we use marker-assisted selection as routine. If we're looking at these new technologies, alien integrations, synthetics, increased photosynthetic efficiencies, we have to use those. If I look historically at alien integrations, what have they done to us? They've done a lot. The 1B1R wheat rye translocation, whereby the short arm of chromosome 1R was transferred to wheat, gave us a yield kick, primarily through disease resistance genes, which have all now been overcome, but nevertheless, it gave us a benefit. If you look at the VPM eye spot resistance, came from Aegilops ventricosa, this poor little goat grass here, which you would step over normally. But this has given us disease resistance, not only foliar disease resistance, but it's given us eye spot resistance. And hey presto, you can use old chemistry now, endopepsidase, but it's still a marker to increase selection efficiency. And the latest ones, we're now using a lot of Triticum dicocoides. Septoria is the most dangerous and damaging disease that we have in the UK. This is the type of material we're getting out of Triticum dicocoides, virtually immune to Septoria. And the variety I mentioned earlier, Stig, that's actually got Triticum dicocoides in there. And out of 300 lines that we would grow in the field, in the high Septoria pressure, 299 would look like this chap, and one of them looks like that. Moving to molecular markers, we now use molecular markers routinely, and this gives me hope, even further hope for the future. About 60 markers are used routinely. These are mainly for diseases, actually the relatively straightforward stuff. We also look at, we now have markers for the developmental genes, for the dwarfing genes, vernalization, photoperiod, herbicide resistance, quality. And we use these in different ways. Choice of parents in the crossing programs, choice of plants in three-way crosses. This is probably the most exciting area of work that we're dealing at the moment, using them to genetically enrich three-way combinations. We use them for allele enrichment in F2s and F3s, doing 30,000 in 2006. We use them for fixed line characterization, tracking genes through the program, and for purification work. I'm going to give a brief example of how I get excited about molecular markers. I'm an old boy, I shouldn't be getting quite so excited about these things, but I just look at the future and I just think this technology is really marvelous. And I use this as the perfect example of how markers should be used. One of the things that hasn't come out, I think, in the discussion this afternoon are the environmental consequences that we have of growing our crops. And one benefit of this particular one is it has huge environmental benefits. Okay, so wheat orange blossom midge, I don't know how many of you know about it. It's the most interesting little beast in the world, actually. I could watch it for hours. But it is a major pest of wheat. But we have identified sources of wheat orange blossom midge. This isn't GM, this is in normal conventional wheat. And we now use marker-assisted selection to push our material through. We have plans actually to change all of our material to resistant. Now what it is, it's an environmentally friendly alternative to organophosphate insecticides. Now those of you who work in the chemical industry, I think it would be best if you closed your ears at this point. I got into some terrible trouble when I mentioned the fact that at the moment farmers are using non-selective insecticides, and I got berated by one of the manufacturers who I got the impression drank this stuff for breakfast, who said there was actually nothing really wrong with it at all. But let us be honest that some of these chemicals are unselective and do damage in terms of they take out the good insects as well as the beneficial insects as well as the pests. And this is an environmentally friendly alternative. With this, you just don't need the chemistry. And now we're pyrimiding these resistance genes with other traits. And this is the pest itself. I won't go into the life cycle. I'm sure some of you may know it already. But if you're aware of it and you do get it in parts of the US, you can spend a very pleasant evening watching these little creatures. They are really quite fascinating. And those of you who've got time on your hands, I would suggest that you go and look it up. But it is a very nasty pest. It will reduce yield by 20-30%. And therefore, genetic resistance, is enormously beneficial. At the moment, we're now finding that we can increase the efficiency of selection by using the particular marker. And as I say, our intention is to change all of our material into resistance. Now, we found this resistance purely by chance, but it does suggest that there is other resistance out there to other major insect pests. So, now I'm going to move on to hybrid wheat. I'll put this question again. I've closed two hybrid wheat programs down. One when it was a Shell program and one when we were working in collaboration with Monsanto. So I ought to be the one person who says, why do we want to do this again? I actually think this is the most fantastic opportunity for hybrid wheat. We've got a number of historical failures, but why? And it's actually down to one thing and one thing alone. Forget about heterosis and all those things. It's seed production. If you could put hybrid seed in the bag at the same price as conventional seed, the whole world would be hybrid. So it's only about seed production. But there is a value there in 3 to 5% in fungicide-treated trials, and actually 5 to 10% in untreated, and actually sometimes more. We have seen evidence of hybrid performance of 15 to 25% higher yielding than conventional self-pollinating wheat. So what we have to do is learn from previous history. Before I die, I will make hybrid wheat, I hope. Now, one thing that was said earlier on is that you shouldn't speculate about the future. Well, I'm going to. This is how I see as the potential yield improvement over the next 20 years. I put the developed and the less developed world here. I think this is breeding per se. We're looking at 1% per annum for the next 20 years. I don't think that's unrealistic, particularly when we take into account the broad genetic range of material that we have available to us and the opportunity to use related species. I put in 5% for hybrid wheat because I'm a firm believer that in 20 years' time, hybrid wheat will be a reality. I put in 10% for GM because in the reality is that we do need to extend the germplasm base. And I'll put in here take all. This is the most damaging disease. If we could transfer resistance into wheat, yield increases in the UK alone would be in the order of 25%. And take that across Europe, when it's obviously a lot. And then I put agronomy. The poor old agronomists are actually slightly less now than it was before. And that's because a lot of the techniques and the technologies have already been utilized. I look at herbicides and I look at fungicides. I look at insecticides and I think, how can these get any better? So I put a barely modest, which gives us a 40% increase in the next 20 years. Now that's not far away from our 50% if we need to feed the world. If I look at the less developed, I'm suggesting that we could go for 30%. That's because I think that the opportunities for genetic development of varieties is greater. But I've now got 15% for hybrid wheat, and that's because in the less developed parts of the world, hybrid advantage will be greater. We're not very good in the UK on hybrid wheat, and that's because we've got too much moisture. Actually, it's a wonderful place to grow wheat. That's why we've got the highest wheat yields in the world. It is a very good place, but the more restrictive the environments, the hotter, the drier, the more difficult, that's where hybrid wheat actually does increase its benefit. And if you take a line from London, take it south and take it east, dissect that line, the further down that line, the greater is the hybrid advantage. And I put another 10% in for GM, and I think that 15% is not unrealistic for agronomic benefits, particularly in the third world. So I've actually overestimated. I suggested 50, we're now up to 70. Now that's a very dangerous, bold, very dangerous statement to make, and I probably shouldn't have made it. But the reality is that plant breeders are optimists. I see no reason why. I've been fortunate to witness over the last 30 years fantastic changes in wheat breeding and in the development that goes with it. I think that we're on the cusp of a new generation. What it really means is that we need to harness all of these technologies together. So, to conclude, I believe that wheat yields will continue to rise. We haven't reached that plateau. But to do that, we need to broaden the genetic base, and we need to do it using a number of disciplines. Again, as in the first green revolution, new crop idiotypes and husbandry techniques will be required. And we have to integrate new technologies, including GM, and it needs to be an interdisciplinary approach, bringing together the resources of both the public and the private sector. Thank you very much.
Anybody like to offer a question? For Dr. Angus? Yes, in front.
If you're bringing your resistance gene to all of your varieties, how long do you think it'll be before the gene breaks?
The question was, how long will it be before our midge resistance gene breaks? That resistance has been around for hundreds and hundreds of years. We found that there was a variety from Eastern Europe. The more you do this job, the more you realize you don't know. It's frightening, really. You're young, you've got plenty of time, but basically, this is what I find such an exciting job. What we found was there was a variety in Eastern Europe, and it was consistently being grown over the last 100, 150 years. No one could understand why it was so consistently good until we discovered that it was actually midge resistant. Now, that's been for about 100 years, to our knowledge, that it's been around. Now, you're quite right, there is a potential for mutation to occur. And what we're doing now is that we're scanning the genetic resources that are available to us using that particular marker to find varieties which are resistant. So we phenotype them as well. And actually, our plans are to incorporate more than one source of resistance. But there are also opportunities for other pests to develop, and I think other pests will develop. There's a pest called lemon blossom midge, which is not prevalent in the UK at the moment, and it's perfectly possible that if you increase the resistance to orange, you may allow a window of opportunity for lemon. I do see that insect resistance is a much neglected part of wheat breeding strategy, and it actually, from the environmental point of view, is one of the most important. But I do take your point on board that we do need to make sure, and I think that we have covered ourselves so far to make sure that resistance will be robust and resilient.
I'm curious about your comment that the poor agronomists will only contribute 5% to yield improvement in the future. I think there's been a number of studies, economic and others, that have suggested until time, but it's more of the order
of 50-70% of the yield improvement. And that's what Dr. Morgan said in the case of rice. I've upset an agronomist here. No, I mean, your question is that 5% is a very conservative estimate, and I would agree. What I've tried to do is to be pessimistic in a way. I have a huge admiration for agronomists in general, because if you look at I think it's very difficult to be a wheat breeder without being an agronomist. And that's why one of the points that I made was the fact that I think that we will see crop idiotypes change. And it's perfectly possible that with those crop idiotypes changing, that we would need to see a difference in agronomy. I think that I would look at opportunities for changes in agronomy, such as precision drilling. I would the reality is that, much as I hate to say it, but we could still have the opportunity for increasing nitrogen, even though it's an environmental issue. But I would argue that we can justify it on the basis of nitrogen use efficiency. But nevertheless, I think a lot of the changes, if you look at the work that was done in Cambridge, a lot of the agronomic inputs, I wouldn't say they've been put to bed, but they've been adopted now. And once they've been adopted, you can't adopt them a second time. It doesn't mean that agronomists are all going to retire, but I just think that I'm being conservative that 5% is what I would see as a relatively modest contribution as opposed to the genetic contribution. Fair point.
In the UK, farmers pay a royalty when they plant back harvested seed. In the US, they don't, for example, on wheat. If you didn't have that royalty scheme in the UK, what effect would it have on your research investments?
Devastated. The reality is that the royalty... Sorry?
Can you repeat that?
Oh, sorry. The question is, what would happen if we didn't have the royalty income, or at least the royalty from Farm Safe Seed, and it would be there would be a very significant negative impact on the progress that we would be able to make. The one thing that is clear is that I tried to balance this relationship between public and private. We would not be able, I think, to sustain our progress in the UK without the public sector. We're very much partnership with that. But they're not very good at exploiting the opportunities that come their way. But I think that if you do not have a reward mechanism in place, then there is no incentive to get this. I mean, I work ridiculous hours, not because it's rewarding, but because it's competitive. And I think that the competitive aspect is something which I and my counterparts, whether they be with Syngenta or with KWS, we love it. It produces another sort of ethos, and it's very exciting. We're very lucky in the UK. The farmers do pay royalties on seed that they put into the ground of varieties that they've kept. And that's no different from if you borrow a book from the library and you photocopy it, why shouldn't you give a reward to the person who wrote the book in the first place? And our farmers recognize that there is a chicken and egg situation here, in that the farmers have got the benefits from new varieties, and therefore they're prepared to invest in their future. If that yield level had been flat, they would not be prepared to invest. And I think that is a bit of a dilemma. If you've got territories or areas where yield progress is not very great, how do you persuade growers that they should invest? We were very fortunate that as soon as they started to invest in royalties, yields kicked off. And they all said, hey, this is great. And at that time, we didn't have farm-safe royalties. And when we introduced them, farmers said, well, actually, yeah, we can see the benefits, but there has to be a benefit for both sides.
One more.
I think he's going to come and kill me. He's got a knife in his pocket. No, he hasn't. It's all right.
You guys are so lucky to have 300 bushels per acre. I worked in the Midwest, where I know that 300 is not even believed to reach, or even 100, sometimes it's really very rare to reach. For two reasons. You are blessed with the moisture, but most of all, you are blessed with long grain filling duration. In Kansas, Nebraska, we don't have that opportunity. Our grain filling mostly is 2 to 3 weeks. Now, the plant itself has very limiting factor how to react with the high temperature. That means the starch synthesis, that is basically is limited and the silices in the plant happen. So in your, I didn't see any part of the physiology. How can we get the plant to survive at 3-4 days of high temperature and then go down when the temperature goes down?
Okay, I've got to praise you that question into how can we change the crop model, I suspect, to take into account short grain filling periods that you get in the US, particularly in the Great Plains. You're right in that we are very, very blessed with the fact that we have high moisture levels and we have a very long grain filling period, up to 8 weeks. And that's one of the reasons that we get high yield potential. But what I would question is I am very committed to crop physiology. I think that most plant breeders are what I call jacks of all trades and probably masters of none. And there is quite a lot of work that, in fact, next week I'm going down to Simmet to talk about exactly the sorts of things that you're looking at, which is how can we change the crop architecture? How can we change the phenology? How can we dredge up some more variability to sustain yield when we've got such short grain filling periods? The only thing I would offer in compensation is that I've given a review of what happens in the UK. I work for a French company. And if you look at France, which has a myriad of crop idiotypes across it, if you look down in the south of France, where they have these very short grain filling periods, you will see significant improvements in yield down there as well, not quite to the same extent. So what I would suggest is that there is genetic variability, and what we've got to do, I think, is to mine that genetic variability. And that's why I reinforce the point that it's not going to be plant breeders who do this. It's going to be a multidisciplinary approach using crop physiologists, pathologists, agronomists, biometricians, all sorts of disciplines. But I do believe that there is scope for considerable improvement even when you've got these very short grain filling periods.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, Bill. Okay.